Yeah, at least he does have, yeah, there's some truth to his arm.
Can anyone hear me? Is the mic working? Yes? No, not sure.
Is it working now? Was that a difference?
Off? Anything?
On? Anything?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe some slight difference. Who knows? Right. Administration things. There are two handouts today. One is lecture slides and also an extract from a book. The chapter called What is a Corpus and What is in It? Which is from a book from about 2000 on corpora and linguistics. So actually, the technology described in it is 10 years old now, and a lot has happened since then, but the science, the methodology, the reasons, and so forth are still entirely relevant. There are should be copies of these by the way in, or not. So of this, have a look at the opening section, read up to about 2.2, but once it goes on there, it's then into technical details, which are kind of interesting, but they're not absolutely up to date. So you can see things, and it'll say, this is what's happening now, or what it means is this is what happened 10 years ago, and things have moved in that direction, but moved quite a lot, which is worth knowing. There's also this handout on XML documents that we had a couple of weeks ago. I had a query from somebody who was missing a couple of pages from this. If she's here, I have a spare copy, you can come down. Anybody else? Was there consistently a page missing from this? Anybody who's actually read it? Well, you all had the copies with all the pages, so that's fine. Okay, there are some constraints here. Because this is a book, we can only photocopy limited amounts of it, and we can't just scan it and put it online. So we have to deal with this business of providing chapters at a time, and if its bits are missing, then come back and we'll photocopy some more and so on. It's a good book, though, so if you buy the book, then you read it. Yeah.
Are there any copies left in the ITO?
If you want, yes, so there are spare copies. It's not in the ITO anymore. On level 5, if you go up to level 5 out of the lifts and turn right, there's a series of shelves with past lecture notes from all the Informatics 1 courses, and also the handouts. Okay. There's also an issue with the next week's tutorial exercises. Pardon me. Which is they're dependent on a tool called Galax, which, or Galax Run is the command for it, which does XML query analysis And we've had significant difficulty in getting this running and working on the latest Fedora release that's on the lab machines. This morning it now worked. Well, this morning we got it to work. It's going to be deployed overnight when the machines pick up their updates. If you want to do it this afternoon, you can reboot a machine and it will pick up the new package. So I'm not sure if it's gone on yet. The teaching assistant for the course is putting up the tutorial sheet with the information about how to run the program and so on about now. If that doesn't happen, it'll certainly be by the end of today. So we couldn't put it up because we didn't have because it wasn't working. If we put the instructions on, they wouldn't have worked. You'd have been confused. We'd have had to change the instructions, and they'd have been far too much back and forth. So the tool is now working as of today. Right, content. Last time, so this first I'm going to finish off some XML things and XPath things from last lecture, and then go on to this lecture, which is about the beginnings of talking about corpus linguistics and reasoning and representing large bodies of text. So we've had XML. We know that it represents tree structure. We have semi-structured data. And then once we've got a piece of XML, probably bigger than you can fit on a slide, we can ask questions about it and get out more information than we could just by looking at it. And one way to do that is through XPath, which is a query language for specifying routes through the tree. And as a query language, what it means is give me all of the nodes that can be found by taking this route or variance through the tree. And this is an example of an XPath document, a gazetteer with countries and regions, the idea being that actually you have lots of countries and lots of regions. And you can then write a path like this, or a short form here, that says, we're looking for regions that contain a mountain. And so the path says, start at the top, that's the slash. Two slashes means go down to some descendant level, doesn't matter how far you have to go, until you find a feature. And from that feature, we want to be able to go down an attribute node, an attribute, the type attribute to be mountain. And if that works, then we go back to the node we were at and take its child and extract the text field. So that's the full form of the path, which says go down and find a feature which is a mountain and tell me the name of it. Sorry, this is not the one about finding the region. This is just finding the name of the mountain. That's an abbreviated form of it. And that's really what I'm going to talk about in a couple of slides, is how we get from the long form to the abbreviated form. So there's this language for walking around trees, navigational queries. This is one that says, find all the regions which have a mountain in them and tell me the name of them. So this says the path is go down the tree, find a feature which is a mountain, then go back up the tree one step and down and get the name of the region and get the text content of that name. So that's a query that, if you applied it to a tree, an XML tree, would return all of the names of all of the regions containing mountains. And the path is, it's more than just a simple straight path. It's down and then do a test exploration to see that there's a mountain in the region. And if there is, go back up and, or down to all the features. For each of the features, check if they're mountains and where they are, navigate back up again and down to here. This is kind of, for me, this is at the limit of where XPath is useful in that you're now walking around quite a lot. It's probably rather sensitive to the exact organization of the tree. So if you change the way the representation is, or if you had a large data set where the representation changes from one place to another in the data, this might begin to break. And it's becoming a little hard to think about. You might do better to step back and have a slightly more abstract query language, like XQuery. But it's doable inside XPath. And so we have XPath as a query language and different kinds of query we saw last time. And there is this abbreviated form. So the query that went down, back up to the parent and down again, the full form of it says, find a descendant, which is a feature, then look to find an attribute that's a type mountain, then go back to a parent node of any kind, find a child that's called name, and then extract a text node from the child of that. So that's a really verbose query. And not much of that is actually telling you about the query. Quite a lot of it is just the sort of chat. And so there's an abbreviated syntax, which is more economical, and it says often more intuitive. That's kind of pushing it a little bit. It's more that it takes idioms from contexts you might already be familiar with, like file hierarchies or web trees and so on. So instead of saying child, you just leave that out because that's almost all, that's the obvious step, right? So the axis, remember there is axis, parent, child, descendant a long way, ancestor a long way up, sibling sideways. So there are these axes. The child axis is the default, so you can leave that out. So you can just do slash, node name, slash, node name, slash, node name to descend a tree. At is an abbreviation for attribute. So if you're looking for attribute nodes, you can just write an at. So you can say at type equals mountain, meaning there's an attribute, which is a type attribute, and the type is mountain. Double slash is an abbreviation for proceed in the descendence or self axis, which means the node itself or its child's child, and so on, until you find a node. So slash means any path of naught or more steps going down. Dot is an abbreviation for the parent node. So /... means explore a path that goes up one node and then start from there. Dot is an abbreviation for self, which seems kind of silly. Why would you need to have a path that then returned to itself? But sometimes that turns out to be useful. We get to that in a minute. So there's an abbreviated syntax. You can have a long expression, and you can cut it down using this micro syntax for more concisely expressing it. You can express queries in more than one way, or you can describe paths that lead to queries in more than one way. So this is one that's the informal query is find the name of every region in which there is a mountain. This is the one we had a while back. And we had the method that said, go down till you find a mountain, then go back up to the region and find its name. This is an alternative one that says, well, go to the region and then do this square bracket path where we remember where we are, explore a new path, and if it exists, then we keep going on the old path. So we say, find all the regions where we can find a feature whose type is mountain. And so for those regions, then go and explore the name and the text. So this thing that's not quite a linear path, it branches a little bit. We explore, we take some side roads, and if that works, we go back to where we were and we continue. So intuitively, we're trying to go from region and extract its name, but we're only interested in regions where, had we chosen to, we could go down and find a feature that was a mountain. And that's a slightly cleaner one than this navigational one that goes all the way down and then back up again. Though you can do, in fact, you can do many of these square bracket ones in terms of paths that go back and up and down and up and down. But it's somewhat more intuitive if you can have only kind of forward progress in your query. So a similar example is countries containing a feature called Everest. So you could say, go down and find the feature and check that its name is Everest, and then go back up two levels, reckoning you're now at the country level, and then go down and find a name and check that it's get its text. And that's it works, but again, it's really sensitive to whether you have states inside countries and regions inside those, or whether you have exactly. So this is relying very closely on navigating precisely from a mountain feature to the name of the country it's in by taking a precise number of steps up and down. And that's a bit fragile for a really structured data format like SQL, that's maybe acceptable. But for a semi-structured one, where maybe the structure isn't uniform the whole way across, that can be a bit shaky. It might work today, but if somebody else starts extending the database or maybe refines it a bit, then you might suddenly find it breaks. This is slightly better. This says, in the XML that we had, matching the DTD that we gave, they're equivalent, but this is slightly more general in its expression. It says, find a country. So // means it doesn't matter how many nestings that country is inside. Find a country from which we can go down to a feature which is called Everest. And once we found such a country, we then extract its name. So this is much more forward going. And here, it's slightly less dependent on the arrangements because we've used the descendant one that says we don't mind how many levels there are. And there's this oddity, we've put the dot there, which says it means start at the country we're at. And the reason is just because of an oddity in parsing that comes from using the abbreviated syntax. It says, if I wrote this query, // country, square bracket, so predicate, a country such that we can find a feature called Everest. Actually, the // would mean go back to the root of the tree. So find a country from which, if we went back to the root of the tree and then look for features, we'd find one called Everest. And that's not what we want. We want to have find a country for which, if we start here and go down some distance, we get to a feature called Everest. So some subtleties in parsing. This is the trade-off of having an abbreviated syntax, which when it works, looks really clean, but sometimes gives you slightly surprising results. In practice, when you're using XPath, there are other things you might need to add. And also, if you're using XPath with a particular tool, then there might be idiosyncrasies of that tool or the workbench that you need to be aware of. So one example is that if you're using XPath query, really you want a full query that says which document you're interested in. So find this path inside this document, or find instances of this path inside this document. And there's other things to do with navigation based on document order. Remember, the tree is ordered, so siblings on the left and siblings on the right are different. And you can navigate to the next sibling along, or you can request the first child of a node. There are namespaces. So here we've got that every node has a name. In fact, so I can do... No, that's the wrong way around. So here every node has a name, and we've got these country population feature tags. And they're pretty much local to the application. We might have another document which also uses a node called feature or a node called name. And once you start having a system which is processing more than one such thing, you begin to get clashes. And that way you could just think of more exotic versions of the names, or you can start to have a namespace that says, this is the name tag from this document used in this sense, and so on. And so there are lots of things like that. And there's a much more rich language of these predicate expressions. I've just given predicates that says something where there is a node like this. And you can get a much richer language where you have conjunctions or implications or more precise specifications of we want to find a node whose environment, whose context has certain properties or a certain shape. And there are tutorials. In fact, there are lots and lots of tutorials around. That's one particular one. And there is also there, that's the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, formal specification of XPath, which is quite a heavy going. Specifications generally are. They're an exact example of highly structured text, actually. They follow a very particular format. But once you get the hang of it, it's not actually a bad resource to go at. If you've tried out some XPath and it doesn't work or it doesn't do what you expect, in fact, reading the specification can be a way, and it's ultimately the only way, to see exactly what it is you've done or why the tool hasn't behaved the way you expect it does. Don't be afraid of reading the original specification documents for these. They are intended to be read at least by people implementing it and to some extent by people using it. So you might find this slightly off-putting at first, but they're really quite approachable. Okay, so that's on XML in general and then querying over XML. We've talked about, so structured data was where we had a database that was really just full of information that was collected purely to be in a database, and it had a very, very fixed structure. We have semi-structured data, XML, which, particularly when you're doing queries over it, is sort of, it's like a database, but you don't want to go to the effort of really organizing the data because it's just not that well behaved for whatever reason. Maybe you're integrating lots of data sets. There's also an approach that kind of comes to the other end to semi-structured data. You get semi-structured data by taking completely unstructured data and adding some structure or discovering structure in it. And one of the large examples of that, and historically one of the drivers for the development of languages like XML and other markup languages, is the linguistic study of large bodies of written text or of written spoken text by people. And they're called corpora, and we're going to talk about corpus work in this lecture and further ones. Before I do that, this kind of thing we're looking at is, as I said, there's a slight issue. This is very dynamic. The reading material is a little bit old. The lecture notes are a few years old, and this keeps moving. So I will be describing, as usual, the underlying, the science and the motivation and the trade-offs continue. But the exact technologies and the size of them changes really, really rapidly. So I had the example back at the beginning of the course of the Google Ngram viewer, where you can take, can we see that? Yeah. So this says, Google Books, they've scanned, as far as they're concerned, they've scanned all books. Books they couldn't scan don't count. There are research labs who have access to, now this is done over about 10%, but they have access to essentially all of that data, and you can do searches like, when do these words appear together? Or when does this word appear at all? Over all books published since 1800. So this is a comparison between the phrase computer science and the phrase informatics, which of course doesn't make a great deal of appearance until the 1960s, though I'm intrigued at this leap for computer science between 1900 and 1910. I have no idea what that refers to. At the time, so a computer was a word, but it was a job. A computer was somebody who sat with a pencil and paper and added up numbers for you. And a parallel computer was a room full of people with pencil and paper who added up numbers for you. And they were seriously used in accounting, ballistics. I mean, military planning for where you had to aim to get your shell to hit the guy over there. could involve rows of people working at numbers and then eventually having little mechanical adding machines doing computation. And so a computer was a person who did that job. So it's conceivable it was a science of working with computers, but I don't know. So up till about here, computer was a regular job description. Then computer science takes off. Fascinating, it completely plummets here. Don't know what's going on there. It's possible, of course, that this is because at this point, that somewhere here we have the digital divide. There's a word for it. There's a point. Yeah, okay. There's a point about here where, from here on, everything is available online, pretty much. Whether you have access to it, whether you can afford that, whether you can afford access to it, is questionable. But all data is put online by somebody at some point. And before then, it's not. Or if it is, it's because somebody's retrospectively put it on. It's quite hard to get. And so it may be this is the point when everything to do with computer science just migrated online and people stop publishing books. Informatics has crept up, but it's still way, way, way behind. So Google Books Ngram Viewer is a massive data set. Enormous. It's much, much larger than the ones described in the handout or that I'm going to describe. On the other hand, it's also pretty unstructured. They've just scanned it. The only data they've got is when this book was published. They do have other information about the title and the author and so on. But it's, at the moment, really, really unstructured. It's very, very raw text. And how those books got in is met. Also, these are the books that Google could get to. It means they were in a library, someone was looking after them. It was a library in the US or accessible to them. It was a library with a particular attitude to copyright access and so on. And so there is a certain selectivity effect in here. There'll be lots of kinds of publication or speech or text that do not appear because they don't make it into libraries or they don't make it into the kind of libraries that Google are looking at. So there's a question of, this is an interesting data set, but what's in it and why is it in it? But it's certainly an area of research. This is the article about putting together Google Ngram Viewer, quantitative analysis of culture using millions of digitized books. And this is the one that I handed out at the beginning where they go into questions of can you spot the civil rights movement in the use of words and so on, and censorship, particular countries or particular languages where certain people couldn't be mentioned and you could, during certain periods, and you could spot that. And finally, they have the guys who do this have a website called Culturomics. Omics, this is a biology where you have the genome, which is the complete entirety of your gene. You then have the proteome, which is all the proteins that are in your cells, and so on and so on. And eventually you just put ome on the end of something. That means I've got an awful lot of stuff, and I'm going to analyze it. So culturomics is the study of the culturome. The culturome is all of human culture, and they're going to study it. And they've got a data set, which is all of these books. So this is, it's very much in the zeitgeist, particularly for Google, this idea of enormous, enormous quantities of very, very unstructured data, and you can analyze it. And that's kind of at one end. And the other end, you have these really tight SQL databases that have exactly the data you asked for and put in. And there's a full spectrum. All the way along, you get the trade-offs between how much data you've got and what you can do with it. You have an enormous amount of data, but you can't actually write a program that walks across it because it's too big. That becomes an issue. Google are very much into algorithms for analyzing this, taking a simple question, even something like one of these XPath queries we've got, and said, well, how would you do that if your data set had 100 million books in? So we're looking at a kind of midpoint in this. I'm going to be talking about bodies of text that are much smaller than this, but are much more curated, is the word. There's more care about what goes into them and what information is attached to them and what kind of annotation there is. So something, that's at one end of the spectrum, SQL databases at the other, and we're going to be exploring some pieces in the middle. Okay. And this recommended reading is this handout. So the book is written for two issues. One is written for people studying linguistics, which might include some of you. And the other is that it's 10 years old. So the theoretical of the linguistics underlying it is good, but the exact technical details are of historic interest. If you read, I'd recommend for the next lecture reading from chapter 2, from the start of the chapter to the end of this section 222 mentioned, and that would be good, and it'll give an alternative view on the kind of things I'm going to be talking about. One more piece of admin. If you want to get, so this may or may not be obvious to people, the course has a web page. The lecture notes are posted to the web page, as are the tutorials. There's a blog on which I post them as well, and comments about the lectures. There's a blog feed to email, so you can sign up with your email address if you'd rather receive it as email. I'm not going to put the whole course mail, the whole year mailing list on that, because not all of you may want that much spam. You can also sign up for RSS feeds and various and Twitter and various other routes to getting that information. If you have a problem, you need to find something out, then on the course webpage, it describes Areti Manasaki, who is the course TA, and Ian Stark, and that's myself, and you're welcome to contact either of us by email or any other means you can think of to ask questions about the course. If you're missing things, if you don't understand details, if we made a mistake in the handout, if we said something that's clearly not true or that you suspect is not true, please let us know. Not least because then we can confirm that, but also relay it to everybody else. My email address is, well, there's various forms, ian.stark@ed.acc is the same as stark@inf. You can also go to the course webpage. The shortest thing I can get you is that I also have a webpage which has some rather out-of-date information on it, but a correct email address, and you can get to that at ians.tk. This is as short as I could make it. So if you need any single piece of information, that will get you it. From there, you can unwind, follow the string, and get to some useful information. Okay. So corpus linguistics. This is, so linguistics is a whole human field of endeavor in itself, and I'm not a linguistics expert myself, but there are people here who are in informatics and in PPLS across the way who are, and they study language, and both the things that are expressed in that language, but also the language itself, and the nature of language itself, and moving towards philosophy, what that tells you about the things we can express and the thoughts we can think and so forth. And language has lots of internal structure. So there's a whole theory of why is language the way it is, what do all languages share in common, and what things might vary between them. How do we understand language? How do we learn language? How are languages created? How do they change over time? Why do they change over time? And so on and so forth. And we're all aware that language has structure. Some of you will have done formal English grammar, either because you're learning English as a second language or because you have the kind of education that says it's important to know English grammar. And so you'll be aware that it has really detailed structure. Even if not, if you just speak a language as a native speaker, you know there are certain kinds of formation that work better than others or that are wrong. So foreigners will use forms of a language that don't feel quite right to you. English is particularly interesting because it has so many people who speak it as a second language. So I speak a particularly posh, native educated form of English, which in an international arena is actually slightly crippling because I don't speak international English. I do not, when I write things, I use all of the English words that I know, which is considerably different to the standard dictionary lexicon of words used by people using English as a second language, scientists who wish to communicate with each other. And so I will inadvertently use a word or an idiom that is completely outside the common wheel of expectation between different people sharing English. Whereas somebody who, two people who have both learned English, international English as a second language, to communicate scientific information to each other, will agree completely on what phrases are sensible and what are not, and I will be outside that conversation. And so there's an interesting structure going on in English there. It's also immensely irritating when there are constructions that scientific English or common international English has, which in terms of British English or American English are wrong. They're just flat out wrong. But more people use them than there are of us, so tough. That's what English is. Winds me up no end. So language has lots of structure, and we can appreciate that it has that. But if you want to analyze it or understand it, or maybe make concrete the kind of random claims I've just made, you need to start to get a more precise handle on it. And on a computer, OK, computers are good for doing precision. You can put text on, but you just get a text file, a sequence of characters. It might involve interesting encoding tricks to do with Unicode, but it's still just a sequence of characters. So that's ultimately unstructured data. And the data format has nothing about it. It's just got a string of characters. And you can do a minimal amount of analysis on that, like the Google n-grams. But even that had some structure, which books came things from. But often you want to know more about it. You want to mark the text up with information about where it came from, what it's for, and then more detailed, where the sentence breaks are, where the clauses within the sentences are, which parts of speech each word is, you know, what role a word is playing in a sentence. Semantic information, what the meaning of the word is, what other words could have been used in that place to achieve equivalent effect, and so on. What other words what are the words that are closely related in a sentence and which are the words that are unrelated? And of course, the different languages, quite what those structures are might be different, because a language might be very heavily dependent on the position of words, or it might be dependent on the word endings or agreement or prepositions and things tying them together. So there's lots and lots of information that you could add to a piece of text to help explain its structure or compare its structure with other structures. And text with that kind of annotation is a kind of semi-structured annotation. It's called marked up text, markup. ML appearing in any of these abbreviations like HTML or XML comes from linguistic study of text, where you say we take some text and we mark it up with this information that we're interested in, which could be, you know, different people have different interests in different kinds of markup. And that is a source of semi-structured data. It's not that you're taking really organized data that's just a bit jangly and loose, like the gazetteer was, and trying to arrange it into as well put as you can manage. The semi-structured data can also arise because you have completely unstructured data to which you then add or discover structure that's in there. In this case, somehow, the structure is latent in the fact that it's a piece of text in meaningful language, but you're adding that structure to it, and you get semi-structured data as a result. You get some data that has kind of locally bits of structure, but overall it's not that every sentence is the same length and they all contain the same words. So if we are trying to study language and we've got this semi-structured data, this text with annotations on it, you want quite a lot of it to start to analyze, and a collection of such text is called a corpus. So it was, historically it referred to a lot of books, but now we're usually talking about electronic representation. It's used in, so computational theoretical linguistics refers to kind of people who write theories about how languages work and how they can be generated, Chomsky, Hierarchy, and so on. Computational linguistics is a bit more about having computers analyze it or generate language. But there's a lot of overlap. And it describes a body of text, just lots of written or spoken text. But it has a rather more precise meaning. So corpus should just be a large amount of stuff. But it, in linguistics, it has a more precise sense of a specific body, a standard collection of text from a particular language or language variety that meets certain criteria. And the motivation behind these is that you want this as an object on which you can do scientific study. It's essentially a tool. So it's similar to a telescope or a particle accelerator or a mass spectrometer. It's a piece of kit, which a corpus is a closely regulated body of text that you can use for linguistic scientific research. But to do so, there's actually quite a lot of science and engineering and technology that goes into constructing a suitable one, in the same way that if you're building a mass spectrometer to do analyses of chemical components, then you need a lot of technology and engineering and indeed original science to build the thing in the first place. And so if a corpus is going to be really useful for analysis, it has to satisfy some fairly tight criteria. So sampling and representativeness is about whether this body of text here really is an appropriate stand-in for the full use of English by some particular population of people. It wants to be of a finite size, needs to be in machine-readable form, and it should be one that several people have used to do their kinds of analysis on. And we'll come back to all of these in the following slides. Sampling and representativeness. So the idea of a corpus is you have a body of text that you can study, and you can try out theories about language. You can say, I think that in French from this period of time, or over time, it was proceeding to that positional information in the sentence mattered less and less as the years went by. Or that a particular kind of foreign language came into English in a certain period, used in certain contexts, and it started in spoken English and then eventually became written English, or something like that. So you could have a theory about something, and you want to test it out. And you can do that on the corpus. You can propose your hypothesis about the language and then test it on the corpus. But that's only a meaningful thing to do if the corpus is... and that's empirical linguistics. That's proposing theories about language and seeing if it's true. And that's useful, but only if the corpus is representative of the real language you're talking about. So it has to be a sample. You'd like it to be a large sample, but it's only ever going to be a subset of the real thing. If we're talking about English printed English in the 21st century, then you're not going to record all of it. And even if you could, you wouldn't know you had all of it. It's actually scientifically much more accessible to have a sample, but then know lots about that sample. You want it to be representative. So the example here is the complete works of Shakespeare, which are readily available in an electronic format. is not a very good representative sample for Elizabethan English, because he was not a very representative Elizabethan. I mean, it's an interesting body of study in its own right, but you could not say facts about the works of Shakespeare tell you directly about Elizabethan English. It's a very specific, particular sample. And actually, for a corpus, you want a real sample. Corpora usually have a fixed and finite size. You say you're going to build a corpus. This is the kind of thing, activity that takes years or even decades to do. And you say, what language are you interested in, how you're going to sample it, and how much you're going to include. And then you build such a sample, and you have a corpus. And it's then fixed. This is useful, because then several people you can propose different theories or competing theories and apply them to the same corpus. Or maybe somebody has done some analysis in the past, and you have a new idea, and you try it, and you want to compare whether your technique is more effective than other people's technique. And the advantage is that they've used their technique on the same corpus. And so you can measure yours directly against theirs. So if you want to use some new and different corpus, you'd have to redo their experiments to compare your technique. So you want it to be a fixed body of text. There are some exceptions. There's a notion of monitor corpora, which we're not dealing with. This is watching a language change over time. So you might have a corpus that says, this is newsprint over in the last couple of years. And over time, either it's fixed size and you drop old things and include new ones, or it just grows over time. So that if you specifically want to study the growth and change of a language right now, then you have a monitor corpus. Finite size for a corpus, it's kind of natural. You can only keep a finite size amount of stuff. And then you have to deal with the fact it's sampled, but you can do that. That's slightly different from theoretical linguistics or generative linguistics when you're talking about all the possible sentences in a language. So, for example, XPath is a language. It's kind of a rather restrictive one. You can only express certain emotions in it, but it's a language nonetheless. And there are an infinite number of XPath queries. And one could study which queries do people actually use, which queries or which styles of query happen, how do they change over time. Remember the Sky Server data set? So the guys who published the Sky data are completely obsessive about making everything public. And so also every single SQL query anybody makes on that database, they keep in another database, which you can also query, and they keep the query, and so on. They're really into this. And they publish that, and it's online. And so you can do analyses on what kinds of query people write, or what kinds of people query write over which data sets, or whether their queries become more sophisticated over time or less sophisticated, what kinds of features the language they use. So that's a language. And we know that SQL, there are an infinite number of legal SQL queries. And so that's because they're all generated by a grammar. And later on, you'll be studying grammars for generating languages, programming languages, specification languages, logical languages, and also those arose from the study of human languages, where people try to evaluate what are the rules of grammar, what are the possible legal sentences. And there you're talking about languages as infinite sets of all possible sentences. But a corpus, we're interested in a finite subset of sentences actually used. So corpus has been used for a long time to refer to, I mean, corpus is Latin, it's been used a very long time, just refers to a body of thing. But specifically used to a body of printed text for study. It referred to really, really books. Now, they're almost always machine readable. That's what makes them useful for doing analysis these days, or certain scales of analysis. And actually, we're only interested in these corpora anyway for this course. This is slightly daft, right? So corpora, usually machine readable. Books are machine readable. It's just a small amount of effort to get it to do it. But so what that means is available to you on a machine, really. And if you have a corpora in a machine-readable format, a corpus in a machine-readable format, then obviously that's much better for analysis. Well, there are various reasons why that's much better for analysis than having it in a big, thick book that you can look at. Big, thick book, you can do sampling from it. You can say, I'll open it at a random page and see what a word is. You could do a small amount of scientific research on that. But if it's stored online, then they can be big. They can be bigger than you can fit on your bookshelf. They can be efficiently searched, and you can improve algorithms and write algorithms to search them faster than the first thing you first thought of. And sometimes, when you've got a big corpus online, you can do automatic annotation. So this idea of curating a corpus, collecting the right kind of information, and annotating it to say, this is a sentence, these are the parts of speech, you can do some of that automatically. And that's a really important part of corpus analysis, is you can have a corpus of just some text, which doesn't say where the sentence breaks are or the parts of speech are. but particularly because it's a large body of data, you can have a machine that will do that. You can have an algorithm that will go over and make the annotations, maybe check by a human afterwards. But you can have, so a lot of corpora have annotations, and you say, great, it has the structure exhibited. And actually, that's not done by a human saying, this is the parts of speech. It's done by a machine. But nonetheless, you get an annotated corpus out. I mentioned this. It is relevant that not a corpus is often a standard reference. And that's not just by chance or because it's a big effort to build one, so once you build it, nobody bothers building another one. Those partly represented. But also, you want it to be a standard reference, and you want it to be available to lots of researchers so that you can compare their research, so their research can build one upon the other and interact. It allows competing theories about a language to be compared against each other. And a corpus is useful as a standard reference if it's representative, and you know the thing it's supposed to represent and so forth. It's a fixed finite size, and so you know how big it is. Any analysis you do on it can be based on its statistical properties, and it's machine readable. Okay, so that's what a corpus is. A corpus is a widely available, fixed-size body, machine-readable text sampled from some larger piece of language, so representing a language or a language variety. And, you know, these are the ideals. This is what you'd like to have of a corpus. You would like it to be really big. You would like it to be really statistically randomly chosen from the language variety you're interested in. You would like it to be annotated with all the information that you happen to be interested in. And you'd like it to be really easily available online. Not any corpus, any actual corpus, will be a trade-off of these things. It'll be maybe not as widely used as the ones, the biggest one, but has the features you want. Or it'll be the most widely used corpus with the most information, but doesn't draw from exactly the kind of language you're interested in, and so on and so forth. But that's how it goes. So here are some, so I'll now talk about some particular individual corpora and how you, and beginnings of how you collect them. Next lecture will be about how the annotation happens, what annotation you might want, and how you put it on. So bear in mind that we're heading towards a really large XML document with lots of structure on the text that tells you about the text that's in there. But we've got to start off somewhere with just some words. So here are some large and widely used corpora. The Brown Corpus of American English, compiled in Brown University, published 40 years ago. It's got 1 million words in it, and this is a big leap forward for the time, to actually compile a corpus and say, we're going to build a corpus that is this big, and you'll be able to do lots of things with it. So it's an example of, as I say, this kind of building a particular piece of equipment for other people to then go and do research on. And that was really started off a whole idea of this is as a scientific construct that you could then do your study on, rather than simply being extremely well-read in a particular language or having learnt it very, very well, so you could then make theories and propose hypotheses about the language that other people might or might not agree with. So there's a lot of history of linguistics of essentially people just arguing with each other, saying it works like this or it works like that. That was the beginnings of starting to say, well, we can test this. We can do an empirical study and see, has the language changed in this way, or do these words always behave in that fashion? The British National Corpus was published in the mid-90s, online from the start. It was machine-readable from the start. It's a 100 million word corpus that's supposed to represent written and spoken British English from the late 20th century. So that's quite big now. This is beyond the amount you just might have read and be knowledgeable about. This is a seriously large sample of English. And I'll say a little bit later about exactly what kind of English is in there. The American National Corpus is an ongoing project to build a corpus of about the same size, 100 million words, of written and spoken American English since 1990. And so this started 10, 15 years ago. It's still ongoing, and they've just released one containing 22 million words. It doesn't contain 22 million words. Sorry. Ignore either the six zeros or the million. And it's published with annotations as XML. So that is that's quite a large XML document. And they release, so I think there's a subset of about half of it comes out free, it's freely available, and then the full set, you have to actually sign up and be involved in the program. And that's growing. But as you can see, building this kind of thing up over time takes a while, because you can't just scrape the web for it. You want to care about what's in it. The Oxford English Corpus, so this is the corpus of English used by the Oxford English Dictionary. They guard it somewhat carefully. It contains over 2 billion words. It's extremely large. It goes back a long way. It's their source for, in the Oxford English Dictionary, saying what the origin of a word is and when it appeared and where it appeared and who used it and so on. So it's an extremely valuable object, and that's not randomly published on the web. It's been curated over the last century or so, and they're extremely proud of it. It's really, really good. And it's very high quality for the particular purpose they want, so it might not be useful for absolutely everybody. It's originated for the dictionary writers, but nonetheless, it's a really good example of a corpus. Okay, you get unannotated and annotated corpora. Unannotated just means here's a lot of text. Maybe it's curated, maybe say it came from here and we looked after it, and it contains English of a certain kind from a certain place, but it's unstructured. If you annotate it, you put on parts of speech, you put on semantic annotations, then it becomes semi-structured data. And all of the ones we talked about, they're all annotated, they're all available in XML. And I'll talk more about them in other lectures. For the rest of this one, I'm just going to say about how you build them up. To make a corpus, you need to do two things. You need to get the data, and then you need to do the annotation. And collecting the data, as I say, it's not just a question of stealing somebody's email feed and seeing all the words that go by. You need to be more careful about this. You need balancing and sampling. Balancing is about, you want to make sure that you really are getting a representative sample of the language that you're interested in. So a balanced text corpus will include text from lots of different sources, books, newspapers, magazines, letters, increasingly web pages, email fora, online, Facebook, social media, and so forth. So you want to get text from wherever text is appearing. And that has to change over time. It can be a real problem if you have a 20-year project to build a corpus, and at the beginning you say it's going to be a balanced English from all kinds of sources, and then during those 20 years, some other source in which people write and read a lot becomes available. Web's a big instance of that. Then you have to rethink how the balancing will go. And once you balance, you decided how much you're going to have from books, how much you're going to have from newspapers, that you are or aren't going to look at web pages, that kind of thing. You then need to sample. You need to think. So this is like any kind of statistical sampling. You have to plan. How are you going to get your newspaper articles? It's not enough just to go and buy the same paper every week. You want to say, well, we'll buy papers randomly, or we'll buy these 5 papers all the time and choose articles randomly from them, and so on and so forth. And it's important not to be too biased by things that are easily available and things that are harder to get hold of, because you want to get language evenly across all of these samples. So balancing and sampling are important things about making sure the corpus you have is representative. And that then increases your confidence in the work that's done analyzing it. So here are the kind of things you might want to take into account in balancing. The kind of language, whether this is a piece of text that has gone through several people's hands and is edited to be readable or to fit a house style or to fit a certain format, or whether it's spontaneous text, whether it's just something's written in order to communicate with somebody else. It doesn't go through multiple rounds of editing different people's hands. It's not trying to be preserved for eternity or match some common format and style. It might be spontaneous speech. There's a lot of people doing recordings of video or radio streams or trying to record people's conversations, dialogue interaction. There's a group here at Edinburgh that does work on people giving instructions to other people and seeing how you structure the language, how you use the language to successfully communicate instructions to a whole group of people about how they'll carry things out and so on. You might have scripted speech or semi-scripted, so kind of this lecture, it's not completely informal. Despite appearances, I don't just come in and gab about stuff that I think is interesting today. It's not quite that. There is some structure to it. I have some idea what's going to happen at the beginning, and it's kind of scripted by the slides. But you get much more precise, formal speeches where a politician gives a speech and everybody in advance knows what he's going to say, in fact. And so that's still a speech. It still has certain conventions of speech, but it's entirely scripted, so it'll be slightly different. So balancing is about choosing what kind of language type you want to record. What genre, what kind of material you're interested in. Are you interested in novels? Are you interested in scientific articles? Are you interested in things from a particular period and so on? And there's another way to slice it, which is the domain. What's the material about? Is this, so you get corpora that are focused purely on the law, for example, or travel writing, a particular scientific field, and then people will study how that works. So the Brown corpus is balanced over written American English. It was this really early one, developed to Brown in the 60s, 1 million words of American English text. So they're working for printed text they could get hold of in 1961. And they specifically chose 15 different genres of text to draw from. So to ensure balance, and also then people analyze it can say, I know what kind of text is in here, it is or isn't suitable for the sort of study I want to do. The BNC is one of the main reference for general English today. It consists of 90 million words of text and 10 million words of speech. And you can tell for any particular part of the corpus whether it's the text, written text or the speech part. The text is from newspapers, books, magazines, university essays, and speech is recorded from volunteers, people asked to talk about